All right, we're starting on the bottom of Mem Chet Amud Bet, 13 lines up. The Gemara is in the middle of the story with regards to the killing of Yoav. Yoav tries to save himself by running to the Mizbeach and holding on to the Mizbeach. And the Gemara is discussing the issue of whether the Nechasim, the possessions of an individual who's killed because he was a Moreid Malchut, do those possessions then belong to the king, or those possessions belong to his Yorshim? The Gemara brought Yoav as an example of why he would have gone to the Mizbeach to protect himself. And that, the Gemara says, it makes sense if he went there because he was afraid of being killed as a Moreid B'Malchut and losing his possessions, because he'd rather die there so that his possessions go to his Yorshim rather than go to the king. And then there's an ensuing conversation between him and Benayahu ben Yehuda, who is representing Shlomo HaMelech. And Yoav says to him, listen, David already cursed me, so take your choice. Either kill me and free me of the curse, or allow the curse to take hold and don't kill me. You can't do both to me. And then we have this memra from Rabbi Yehuda. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Kol klalot shekilel David et Yoav, nitkaimu bizaro shel David. The curses that David placed upon Yoav all came true or were manifest in the descendants of David. So here David curses Yoav because what he does to Avner. Avner is the Tsar Tzava of Shaul. Yoav is the Tsar Tzava of David. He happens to be a family member as well. They were relatives. And David tries to bring about a unification of the Malchut between Yehuda and Israel. Avner really is the one who precipitates it by coming and offering the opportunity to bring the people to David HaMelech and to bring a peaceful resolution through the unification of Klal Yisrael. Avner, after visiting David on his way out, Yoav chases him down and kills him. Now, he could have killed him for a number of reasons, one of which is stated in the Navi, or the way that Yoav expresses it is that Avner could be coming and playing a trick here. He could have been coming in to spy on David to see what's happening in the city. He's trying to get information about the city. The other reason is that Yoav might feel challenged by Avner, which is that if David brings about peace, first of all, he might use Avner as a individual to support his reign over Israel and appoint him to be the Tsar Tzava and replace Yoav, as well as the fact that Avner's power would be then increased, and Yoav's afraid of that. So Yoav ends up killing Avner, and he does it in a underhanded way, and David curses him for doing that because he almost is able here now to spoil the opportunity to unify Klal Yisrael and Yehuda. So David curses him for doing that, for spilling the blood of Avner, and David then has to go out of his way to demonstrate to the Bnei Yisrael, not Bnei Yehuda, but Bnei Yisrael, that he wasn't the one who commanded Avner's death, and that he wasn't involved in this scenario, and that he's innocent. And then he does this whole demonstration, so Bnei Yisrael believe him in the way that he acts, and the avelut that he has over Avner, and the speech that he gives about it. So there he curses Yoav for what he did, and he says, "Ali charet mi beit Yoav, zav umitzora umachzik bepelach, nofel becherev bechoser lechem." So here he says, all of these things will come true into the descendants of Yoav. So zav in mitzora, which we know are sicknesses, machzik bepelach is walking with a cane, and nofel becherev is those that die by the sword, bechoser lechem, those that go hungry. Zav mi rechavam, we know that from Rechavam, dichtiv ha-melech rechavam hit ametz la'alot v'merkava lanus Yerushalayim. He made efforts to get onto his chariot to get back to Yerushalayim, to escape. Uchtiv v'chol merkav esher yikav alav azav itma. When it speaks about the zav in Parshat Mitzora, over there it uses the merkav esher yikav alav azav is something that becomes tamei. Gemara does an agadic gezeirah shava between merkav to say that Rechavam was a zav. Mitzora mi'uziyahu. Mitzora comes from Uziyahu. Dichtiv here, it's more explicit. Ubechezkato gavali bo. Uziyahu, once he is successful and reaches a high point of his reign, he decides that it's not enough that he's the king. He also wants to be the Kohen Gadol. And he goes into the Mikdash, and the Kohanim are trying to dissuade him from doing this. But he pushes forward anyway in order to be the Kohen Gadol or to be Makriv the Ktoret. And therefore he abrogates what have been the norms with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, v'yavoy le'echal Hashem, naktir le'mizbeach ha'ktoret. And he comes to the Mikdash to sacrifice to bring a ktoret, which is the realm of the Kohanim. Uchtiv atzarat zachah b'mitzcho. And then suddenly, Tzarat breaks out on his forehead, and they whisk him out of the Beit HaMikdash at that point in time. Again, it's just an interesting dynamic about how he was willing all along to go ahead and override the word of Hashem and take over the kuhuna and being makriv the ktoret. As soon as he has tzarat, they take him out. He surrenders to whatever it is. It's interesting in terms of that dynamic and how it wasn't even a question once he was in Mitzora that he had to leave and that he no longer was capable of being a kohen or maybe even being the king. Maksik v'pelach mi'asa, dichtev rak la'id ziknato chala et raglav. As he aged, his legs gave way. That he was taken over by some sort of debilitating disease, which some associate with gout of the feet, which causes his legs to give way. What is this disease like? How does it feel? It's like putting a needle through live flesh. I mean, he's having someone stick a needle into you. But no, Yoda, how did Rav Nachman know what it felt like? That he had a sensation of it, or maybe even experienced it. Some say that he learned it from his Rebbe. It was a Masora from his Rebbe, or whether his Rebbe had that as well. That sometimes the Talmid Chachamim get information that is not otherwise known. The secrets of Hashem are given to them because of their status as a Talmud Chacham. So he had an understanding of this, despite the fact that he had no Masorah or experience with it. Nofel b'cherev mi-Yoshiyahu, those that draw fall by the sword from Yoshiyahu, dichtiv, v'yowah yorim, l'melech Yoshiyahu, and so they were shooting at Yoshiyahu, v'amar Rav Yehuda marav shasu ko gufo kikvara, that they made his whole body into a sieve, in that he was hit by so many arrows that he was bleeding everywhere. Now, it's true here that it says by cherev, by the sword, and yet it's talking about by the arrows that he died, but I think the idea by the sword doesn't mean literally by the sword means by war, by the battle, and Yoshiyahu loses his life in the battle with Necho Melech Mitzrayim, trying to stop him from traversing Eretz Yisrael, and there he's killed in the valley of Megiddo. And in the fourth parak, Menech, that we read, Kina, by Yirmiyahu, over the death of Yoshiyahu. And one of the keynote that we read on Tisha B'Av, which begins with the quote from the Pasuk that is found in Divrei Yamim, by Yikonein Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. It's about the death of Yoshiyahu. Chose lechem mi Yochonya, dichtiv, baruchato aruchat tamid natna lo. So that after Yochonya is taken into Galut by Nebuchadnezzar, he brings him to Bavel, and he imprisons him. And then 37 years later, he's freed by Evel Merodach, who gives him a seat amongst the kings that are there. And then he gives him an allocation. As the king, he gives him an allocation of food. That means that Yochanan was no longer independent. He was dependent before whatever that he ate and anything that he had. It's an important principle. I think it has broader application than just here. Te lota v'lo te la'ata. Better to be those that are cursed than those that curse, because of what we just saw here, which is that David, who gave the curse, in the end, the curse rebounded and ended up on all of his descendants, rather than on the intended recipient, who was Yoav. And that is a more general principle that we see. Rashi over here says, Lefish Yosof Kilat Chinam Leshuv Ela Mikalel, that a Kilat Chinam ends up returning to the one who gave the curse. Rashi here says kilat chinam, which was that it was an unjustified kilala. Over here, I'm not sure it was unjustified. When David gave it to Yoav, there was a reason he was cursing him. Maybe it was too extreme. Maybe it was too much. It was not in tandem, which was what you would have expected. And that goes to an explanation that we've spoken about before, but sinat chinam. Sinat chinam doesn't mean baseless hatred. Sinat chinam means that something that is not measured in its response, that the hatred or the reflection that a person has on the other party is not in proportion to the crime that had taken place. And so, sinat chinam is where, if someone does something to you or wrongs you, how much hatred do you reflect back because of that? Do you hold a grudge are you angry more than it should be justified based on the little thing that he did to you? And that's sinat chinam. So it's over here, maybe kilat chinam is something where the curse, what didn't befit the crime necessarily. Yes, he did something wrong. Yes, he maybe should have dismissed them. Maybe he should have done something. But in the end, he gives them this curse that is extreme in nature, that all of his descendants should have all of these problems amongst them. And maybe that's called kilat chinam because it wasn't proportional to the issue or the violation that Yoav had done. It might be no right to punish him, but what about all of his descendants, everybody around? I mean, it was extreme. I'm just suggesting that the kilat chinam maybe means that it was disproportionate response to Yoav. Truth is that he should have gotten rid of Yoav, but David is a little bit afraid of Yoav. Yoav is a huge part of David's success over time. He is the Tsar Tzava. He is the one who helps him in many circumstances and situations. And so David HaMelech maybe should have taken issue immediately and taken care of this situation with Yoav. And yet he persists for years until finally David has enough with him when it comes to joining the rebellion of Adoniyahu, and he tells Shlomo to eliminate Yoav. But you see here that David maybe should have acted against Yoav, not curse him or his descendants in that way. And so maybe that's what the Kilat Chinam is. And this has a, I think, broader implication than just klala, which is that whenever you wish bad upon someone else, in all likelihood that bad comes back or rebounds on the individual, because whenever you ask someone else to be prosecuted by Hashem, they look at you and say, are you so clean slated? Are you really so deserving that we should follow your instructions and bring evil or bad upon someone else? Maybe you deserve it. Maybe there's something wrong with you. And so the same thing over here, this idea of being the victim rather than the aggressor, the Gemara says it's better to be in that position because when you're the aggressor, they look more carefully into your deeds. All right. So they brought Yoav in order to judge or figure out what they should do with him. So it seems over here that Shlomo HaMelech, even though as the king he had a right to kill him, he still either convened a Beit Din in order to deal with it, or he actually brought him to the Beit Din. Now they want Yoav to explain his actions. Why did you kill Avner? I was the Goel Adam for my brother Asael. Avner had killed Asael in an earlier battle or altercation between Israel and Yehuda. Asael, who was the brother of Yoav, was chasing after Avner. And Avner a number of times calls to him and says, back off, back off. And Asael refuses to back off Avner. Avner is a true and tried warrior. And he knows that Asael is no match for him in the end. And so that's why he keeps telling him, don't follow me, don't do this, because it's not going to end up well. Asael refuses to, and therefore Avner turns around when Asael catches up to him and kills him. So now Yoav, as the brother of Asael, feels that he's the Goel Adam to take revenge for Avner. But that supposes that the killing of Asael was unjustified. Avner gave numerous warnings to Asael to back off, and he didn't listen, and then he kills him. So now the Shlomo says, Asael rodef avo. Asael was chasing Avner to kill him. He was justified in protecting himself by killing Asael. Amalei hayalo latzilo be'echad mein verav. He should have saved himself by injuring Asael rather than killing Asael. This is a principle that still exists in the law today, which is that you have to use the lowest means of force possible. If you use extreme force in a place where lesser force can be used, you can't be held liable for doing that. So if you're in a position where you can save yourself by simply injuring the individual or doing something to the individual and not killing them, but then you use the force and kill them, then it's extreme force. And we hold you liable for acting in that way. Now, certain circumstances, people are uncertain. People are afraid, or they can't make a decision. They don't know what to do. Then in those cases, we can justify their killing because they just didn't know how to react, or that was the way they thought they would stop the situation. But in a situation where there's more precision, then the individual should make the effort to maim the other party rather than kill them. That's true in military rules today. And police actions where you shoot at the legs first, not at the head, to try to injure the individual rather than kill them. So that's what Yoav responds and says he should have stopped Asael and not killed him. What are you talking about? He didn't have a choice. He's being chased by Asael, who's a warrior, and he needs to do something immediately, so he turns around and kills him. He said, wait a minute, he was so exact in where he killed him then of course he could have taken that same action with regards to injuring him. That Abner kills him with the back of the sword into the fifth rib. The fifth rib, as you see many times over in Shmuel, is the location or the favorite location of warriors to kill. When you count up the ribs, it's starting from the bottom, you count five ribs up, it's the location which the Gemara Amar Rabbi Yochanan bedofen chamishit b'makom shemarav v'kaved tkuim bo. It's the place where the liver and the spleen meet, or they're hanging, they're closest to the rib cage in that location. And therefore, it's a location that is deadly when the person kills or stabs into that location. So Abner was able to kill by puncturing or stabbing him in the exact location. That takes precision, training. That's something that is very exact in nature. It's not that he's just swinging at him to protect himself. He killed him in a very precise way. That's what he's saying. If he could get him right in the fifth rib, then he could have cut his leg or could have cut his arm or done something to stop him and not kill him. So Yoav says the precision in which Abner killed him already indicates that he had control and he knew what he was doing, and therefore it's premeditated in what he did, and he should have done it in a different manner. The truth is that a warrior like Abner is trained to do that. That's how he works. I mean, that these are expert warriors, and expert warriors are trained to kill or to hit in that specific location because it's the most efficacious. And so may not have been an indication of precision, but rather just of his craftsmanship, we would say here, his expertise at being a warrior, and that anytime he hit somebody, anytime he was in war, that's where he would have gone for it, because that's what he was trained to do. But nevertheless, Amalei Nezel Abner. They accept his claim, and let's leave Abner behind. So the Gemara here indicates that the Beit Din accepted his argument that he was in a Goel Adam in this situation, and therefore he was justified in killing Abner. Gemara will come back and discuss it again. So just know in general, the Agadata here follows a pattern in Chazal, which is that they take stories in Navi and they superimpose upon them halachic discussions or halachic issues, and that the arguments or differences of opinion relate to a halachic issue rather than the stories of Tanakh. I mean that they are bringing to life halacha inside of the Navi. My time katalte la masa. So now they move on to discuss why did you kill a masa? So here again, this is the second general that Yoav killed. Here, Abner, who made peace with David, in a sense, is a challenge to Yoav. The same thing happens with Amasa. After the rebellion of Absalom, the Sar Tzava of Absalom was Amasa. Again, just as a side, they're all family. Yoav, Amasa, Absalom, David, they're all family members. But Amasa was the general of Absalom's rebellion. After the quashing of the rebellion, David tries to bring peace with the rebellion, and therefore he accepts Amasa's suit for peace, and appoints Amasa to be the general of his army. So David had forgiven him for being a part of the Morid B'Malchut, the rebellion of Absalom. Because otherwise, Yoav could have just answered, Amasa was Chayav Mita because he joined the rebellion of Absalom. But the truth is that David had already forgiven him, and appointed him as the Tzar Tzava. He had basically knocked off Yoav. The reason likely being is because Yoav killed Absalom. David had specifically asked that Absalom not be killed. Yoav kills Absalom, and then afterwards Yoav forces David to get out of this crying state of mourning over Absalom and to take care of the people that supported him during the rebellion. So David has, I think, ill will towards Yoav over this, and he appoints Amasa and basically knocks off Yoav in that way. What you see again and again is that David really wants to dispose of Yoav, but he can't do it directly with Yoav, whether he thinks he's not strong enough, whether he needs Yoav's support. But every time he does it, he appoints someone else to replace Yoav, and then Yoav eliminates the person once he's replaced. So to over here, Amasa. Amalei Amasa Morid B'Malchut Abba. He says that Amasa was a Morid B'Malchut, not a Morid B'Malchut for joining the rebellion of Shalom, but for rather Dichtiv. Vayomer Melech Amasa, Hazekli et Ish Yehuda Shloshet Yamim. So post the rebellion of Absalom, there's a subsequent rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, and David HaMelech needs troops to go deal with the issue. So he sends out Amasa, the new general, to raise the troops. Vayazik means to call out, to scream, but it means to make the announcement. We need our troops, everybody gathered together. It was the military draft of their time when you call up troops. This is how they did it. So he went ahead to call up the troops, but he delayed, he tarries. He does not succeed at doing it in the 3-day window that David HaMelech gave him. And Suav says he failed to follow the orders of David. Amalei, Amasa, Achin, V'Rakim, Darash. So Shlomo responds to Yoav and says that he was Doresh, Achin, V'Rakim. Ashkichinu, Debtichu, Masechta. He found that they were opening up the new Masechta. Amar, Ktiv. And then he, this is Amasa speaking to himself. Kolish, Asher Yamred, Picha, V'lo Yishma, Dvarecha. Anybody who violates your word or doesn't listen to what you say, the cholasher titzavenu, anything you command them, you mat. So this is Yoshua, who's being appointed as the leader of Bnei Israel, the king of Israel, and the Bnei Gad, Bnei Ruvain, basically pledge allegiance to Yoshua and say that anybody who violates the word of Yoshua is subject to death. The king's word is paramount, and anybody who violates the word of the king is deserving of a death penalty. And so here, Amasa is trying to make a decision. The king told him to be back in 3 days. If he lets them finish the opening of the Masechta, he's going to be late. Otherwise, he's going to have to shut down the Beit Midrash and take the troops out and say it's time to go. So the question was, which is more important? And that's what Amasa is in his own mind working through. He's saying, wait a minute, it says anybody who violates the word of the king is subject to a death penalty. Yechol afilu de divrei Torah. You think it's applicable even by Torah? Tomalomar rak chazak ve'ematz. Just be strong and courageous. And the rak here, that's what he's saying, doresh achin v'rakin. The rak is a miut to tell you that there are certain circumstances where you need to take a stand, or certain circumstances where you do not have to listen to the king or the leader. And that is in cases where he is asking you to violate the word of the Torah. The king asks you to do something that's against the Torah. You do not have to abide by his word, and you're not considered to be a moreid b'malchut in that situation. Over here, the Gemara is darshaning it, I think, more loosely, which is that over here they were osek in Torah. And therefore, for bitul Torah, you don't have to listen to the king. Because the king here doesn't need, if the troops come a drop later, it's not going to make a huge difference in the situation. And therefore, defying the king's word in order not to be mevatel Torah is justified. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech is answering to Yoav. He was justified in delaying because had he broken up the Beit Midrash, which was called the Pticha LeMesechta, when they started the new Masechet, they would gather all together. This was every 6 months or so when they had the big gatherings around the Regel. Then the leader of the people, the Talmud Chacham, whoever was the Nasi, or the Reish Galuta, or the greatest Talmud Chacham, would open up the Masechta. He would give a shir, klali, on the Masechta so that everybody knew what Masechta they were learning, what principles were going to be learned. And then everybody went home over the next 6 months and they learned the Masechta. So it was the introduction to the Masechta. So he didn't want to interrupt that, and therefore he delayed or tarried. Ella, how God from Moreid B'malchut Abba? But rather, Shlomo responds and says, you, Yoav, are the Moreid B'malchut here, not Amasa. Dichli, because the pasuk says, Vashmoa ba'a ad Yoav, Yoav natach rei Adonia, because Yoav joined the rebellion of Adonia, or the anointing of Adonia, v'chrei Avshalom lo natah, but he had not followed in the rebellion of Avshalom. So here, the pasuk tells us that Yoav has joined in the rebellion of Adonia, and then he hears that the king has anointed Shlomo HaMelech to be his successor, and he knows that now he's in a bad position, because the king has appointed Shlomo, and he's gone after Adonia. So he's not going to be in good shape. But now, the Shmua Ba'ad Yoav, Yoav hears now about this situation, because Yoav has followed Adonia, but the pasuk also says he didn't follow Avshalom. So it says, my lo nata. What does it mean they didn't follow Avshalom? Of course he didn't follow Avshalom. He wasn't part of that rebellion. He was David Sarzava at the time. Amar Yehuda, she bekeshed and told v'lo nata, that he had in mind, or he considered, joining the rebellion of Avshalom as well. My time alone ata. So then why didn't he do that? Amar Abelazar, adayin lichluchit shel David kayemet. Because David's youth, or here lichluchit means his moisture, or his wetness was still alive, means that David was still young. Now that could have implications in a number of matters. Either David was still strong, he was still a gibor at that time, and Yoav felt it was dangerous to rebel against David. Could have been that he felt that David was the true king and Absalom was not going to succeed, and that Hashem was with David and therefore wasn't worth it. Over here, he's not going up against David. He's picking one of David's successors or children to succeed him. So it's a different type of rebellion. It's not going against David directly. Or it might have been that they still had feelings for each other. David and Yoav spent a lot of time together. They did a lot together. And David's kingdom was really dependent on Yoav. And Yoav's successes were also dependent on David. And so they did have a relationship that he didn't feel comfortable abrogating. But that doesn't mean that he might have not thought about it. He might have considered it because he was at odds with David over other issues. And we know that number of times that David tried to replace him, he might have thought about trying to replace David as well. So Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanina, Amara, Dain, Itztag, Migei, so David, Kayamin. Normally, the word is translated throughout Shas as being astrologers, that the astrologers of David were still around. And Rashi notes that fact, that generally, that's what it means. But over here, it has a different meaning, which is Balei Egrofim Shelo. It means the strong men of David, his warriors that he had, the army. And here might have been the special forces of David that he had. Because they were the ones who led the battles, and they're the ones who gave advice to David HaMelech. And here Rashi explains, it's Tagnikut, Tuchol Shash, Lashon Mazalot, V'chuzim V'kochavim. Anytime else in Shas, when you see this word, it means astrologers, means the people are reading the zodiac, following the Mazalot. V'hana kari hochi mishum she'ed David nismach aleihem. So it uses this as maybe a euphemistic term, or maybe even as a borrowed term, which is David followed their advice. David was dependent on them, similar to the way that people feel about astrologers or the mazalot, which is that the people's lives are dictated by the mazal under which they are born or under which they are existing now, and they either rely on them or they are dictated by them. And so too, David over here was relying on these individuals, dictated his course of action based on them, and so they are similar to the mazalot. So Rashi says that it's either, again, euphemistic or a borrowed term to say it's the negay here. It doesn't mean literally astrologers or a choseba kochavim, mazalot, but rather it's used in a similar way. People upon which you are reliant. People upon which you take advice from, and these are the balei gufim of David. David had 400 children, kulam b'nei Yifat Toar. They were all born of the incidents of Yifat Toar, this week's parsha that we just read about Yifat Toar. It's not necessarily that they were literally Yifat Toar. The Gemara uses the term Yifat Toar more loosely, especially with regards to David, to mean marrying a non-Jewish woman. Doesn't have to be necessarily in the circumstances or situation of Yifat Toar, like it's described in the Torah, but David entered into alliances with other kings, married their daughters. That's who Avshalom was born of. Avshalom was born of a marriage between David and Bat Talmai from the king, the daughter of the king Talmai, and an agreement or an alliance or a peace arrangement between them. And in some senses, the Midrash calls him a Ben Yifat Toar, Avshalom and Tamar. That they were the bed and bath of Yifat Toar. Megadle Bloriot, Bloritayu, they cut their hair, they wore their hair similar to the way of the Ovdei Kochavim, which is that they shaved the sides of their heads, and they had this type of mohawk that went with a ponytail coming up the back, and that was to instill fear in the enemy. So the enemy saw that these big individuals, and maybe of their own ilk, were there, that would scare them. Machim Roshia Gaisotayu, they were the leaders, the front forces, the primary forces of David. Behein Balei Gufim Shel David, these were the strong men of David. And so Yoav was afraid of these individuals. David had strong support and people that were loyal to him. And so Yoav, at the time of Avshalom's rebellion, felt it wasn't wise to leave David because David had those that were loyal to him that would take retribution on Yoav. Upliga de Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, and this argues on Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana's assessment of the situation or relationship between David and Yoav. Dama Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Imalei David lo ase Yoav milchama, had not been for David, Yoav would not have been successful in battle. Imalei Yoav lo asak David b'Torah. If it wasn't for Yoav, David would not have been able to spend time learning Torah. Which is that there is this symbiotic relationship that exists between David and Yoav, which is David's Torah gives protection and success to Yoav's feats in battle. And Yoav's feats in battle free up David to allow him to deal with the Torah, learn the Torah and teach the Torah. Dichtiv. Vayi David oseh mishpat utzdaka l'chol amo. David engaged in mishpat utzdaka for his whole nation. Vayav ben Tsruya al hatzava. And at the same time, Yoav is the general of the army. So here he sees a correlation between the two positions that are being mentioned here. Matam David oseh mishpat utzdaka l'chol amo. Why is David able to do tzedakah mishpat for his own nation? Mishum d'Yoav al hatzava. Because the military matters are being handled by Yoav. Mata Yoav al hatzava. And why is Yoav's being the general and succeeding in military feats? What is that? Mishum d'David oseh mishpat utzdakah l'chol amo. Because of David's actions on the home front, that gives protection or help or siyata d'shmaya to Yoav out on the battlefield. Now, the Gemara says here, it's a Torah and Milchama. Those are the two items that are being discussed. Yet it brings a pasuk that David was oseh mishpat utzdaka. Mishpat utzdaka is a way that one conducts themselves towards others. That he was righteous and just in what he did. He treated people in the right manner. He adjudicated the cases and brought to bear the law in a fair way so that people felt that they were treated properly by the king. So then what is that an indication of Torah? So the Marsha claims over here, it has to do with the last part here, Mishpat Utzdaka, L'chol Amo, that he did it for his whole nation. The only way you can be successful at doing Tzedakah Mishpat to everyone is if you follow the precepts of the Torah. And so that's what it means. He freed him up to learn Torah so that David could act Tzedakah Mishpat L'chol Amo to his whole nation, and that's based on the principles of Torah. But you see here this symbiotic relationship between the military and the Beit Midrash, and that they are both needed, one for the other, the acknowledgement that the military needs the Torah learning and the Torah leading needs the military. So definitely still an issue till today or a discussion today amongst the people. David, Abner, so Yoav sends out messengers to Abner, and he brings them back from Boras Sirah. So here, Abner leaves after striking the deal with David HaMelech. Yoav was not present at the situation. He was out. And he only comes in later to find out that Abner just visited the city while Yoav was missing. Yoav wasn't in the city of Hebron when he visited David. And then he's left. And then Yoav gets the story about what happened here and David's bringing about some sort of unification through a peace. And so Yoav's not very happy about what happened behind his back. And now he calls back Abner, but he makes it look like as if the king is calling back Abner. So Abner says, all right, I gotta go back, they're calling me back. My bor asira. Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, bor visira garmulo Abner she'areg. That a bor, a cistern, and a sira caused Abner to die. And that is going to be explained now by the Gemara what that is. A bor is a cistern, a sira is a coats, is a thorn. And as Rashi points out here, that both of those are hints at incidents that took place between David and Shaul. When Shaul is chasing down David, and David is able to sneak up upon Shaul, and he takes something without hurting Shaul. One time he took a pitcher of water and his dagger, and then he calls out to them and said that you were deserving of death because you didn't protect your master, you didn't protect Shaul. I was able to kill him, but I didn't. And similarly, in the case where Shaul goes to defecate and David is in that cave and is able to, if he wanted to kill him, cuts off a corner of his cloak and shows that to say, listen, I had mercy on you, I didn't kill you. In each of those cases, Abner, quote-unquote, is deserving of death for not protecting his master, but also should have spoken up on behalf of David and said to Shaul that David is not really looking out for your detriment, but rather for your betterment, and maybe we shouldn't be chasing down David. The fact that Abner doesn't do that, and even in the case of the cutting of the garment, says maybe your cloak got caught on some nettles or thorns, and then he got that piece, and that's what he's showing you. He even tries to dissuade Shaul from believing David in that case. And for that reason, he is deserving of death because of the fact that he didn't protect Shaul properly, but more importantly, he didn't speak up on David's behalf. And that's what is being hinted to here in the Navi and leads to his death at the hands of Yoav. Vayateo Yoav el toch hashar. Yoav basically tricks him or in a cunning manner brings him into the gate of the city and the entrance of the city of Hebron. Ledaber ito b'sheli. To speak to him b'sheli. The translation of the word Bisheli, the Gemara is going to deal with in a second, but the word means, and it's used in a number of places in Tanakh, it means to do it in a misleading manner. Like the Isha Shunamit says to Elisha, Al tashle et amatecha. Do not mislead me. Do not put up smoke and mirrors around here. When he promises her that she's going to have a child, she says, Al tashle et amatecha. Don't make these promises or make me feel like I'm going to have a child and not have a child. But it's this idea of making a commitment that you're not going to be able to follow through on, or basically misleading the other individual. So it's used here. It's also used by Yehuda. The name of his third child is Shelah. And that's because of what he does with Tamar, Shelah, which is that he tells her to wait around for Shelah to grow up. And then she sees that Shelah is grown up, and Yehuda has no intention of giving Shelah to her as a husband. So the same word there, Shelah. And over here, Bisheli is used in the same manner, which means that he's doing it in a manner that is not straightforward. He's trying to trick or mislead Avner to come. He's trying to make Avner feel secure, and that he has some message from the king to tell Avner, and therefore Avner will put his guard down, and that'll give Yoav an opportunity to kill Avner. So now the Gemara says, Amar Yochanan Shedano Din Sanhedre, that he brought him to basically the Sanhedrin. That doesn't necessarily mean literally, but rather he said that you are a chayav mita. This goes back to the discussion we saw before, that Yoav feels that he is the goel adam for his brother Asael, and he's justified in killing Avner. Question is, why didn't he bring him to court then? If he was justified, and in the end, Shlomo Melech agrees that maybe Yoav was justified, how come he just didn't bring him to court? Why does he take the matters into his own hands? The answer likely might be based on what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that if you have the ability to save your life by one aver, and then you kill the individual, you are considered a rotzeach. You are considered a killer, but Beit Din cannot charge you. Beit Din cannot prosecute you based on that. So you have almost duality that exists over here, which is, you're considered a murderer because you had the ability to save your life with lesser force, but you used force to kill. So you're classified as a rotzeach, but nevertheless, Beit Din does not have the right to adjudicate that case. Goel Adam is the only one who has a right to kill. And that might be what Yoav is saying over here. The Din Sanhedrin is that Sanhedrin doesn't have the right to kill you because you used lethal force against Asael when you could have used less force. So you are a rotzeach. Beit Din can't do anything, but I, as the Goel Adam, can take the matters into my own hands and kill you. Over here, the Gemara interpolates a conversation between Yoav and Avner in the Shar. What happens in the Navi is simply that Yoav tricks him into coming to the Shar and he kills him. But over here, the Gemara interpolates that there was a conversation that took place before Yoav killed him. And that is, my time of Katledle the Asel. Why did you kill my brother Asel? So Avner responds and says, Asel Rodefaya. Asel was chasing after me to kill me. So Yoav responds and says, Eilecha Latzilo b'chad me'verav. You should have stopped him with one of his limbs. You should have used less than lethal force. You didn't have to kill him. Lo yachilalei. He says, I couldn't do it. I didn't have a choice. It was, the circumstances were too tight. The issue was too difficult, and I just had to make a split-second decision, so I killed him because that's the only thing I could have done. Hash v'dofen chamishit kivantlei. You were able to be so exacting in where you killed him in the fifth rib. You couldn't have aimed or been directed at one of his limbs, meaning that you used such precision that you should have been able to maim him instead of using lethal force. So the Deberito Bisheli, so the Navi says the Deberito Bisheli, what does that mean? Amri v'damarav, al-iske, here there are different girsot, whether it's shalo or iske shal. Those are what he was discussing with him. And here the Rashi describes for you what that means. Rashi says iske shalo, Lashon sha'al na'alecha, to remove your shoes. Then they're talking about Moshe by the burning bush, where he has to remove his shoes. The word sha'al means to take off your shoes. So he's saying the word sheli here, or sha'al, is connected to the removal of shoes. Sha'al lo, it's also connected to the word sha'al, to ask a question. And so Rashi learns over here that the question that was posed to him is about something about removing shoes, which is the following. Be'orma, he did it in a tricky way, a cunning, conniving way. Yivama gidemet eyacheoletzet. A yivama who doesn't have an arm by which to untie the shoe of the yavam. How do you go about untying the shoe of the yavam? Hitchil socher lefanav. He bowed down, I mean he bent down in front of him. Umareu kachi choletzet b'shineha. She uses her teeth to untie the shoe. V'ushalaf charbo v'arago. And Yoav, when Abner's in that compromised position, kills him. V'charbato asher b'matnav, u'b'nalo asher b'raglav. Because he killed him with when the belt was around his loins, and his shoes were on his feet, meaning that he killed him while he was innocent or unaware. He was unassuming at this point. He thought Yoav was speaking to him or had something to tell him from the king. The truth is that it looks more like that, which is that Yoav says, I have a message for you, and Abner's leaning in to hear what the king had to say, and then Yoav kills him because he is caught off guard. The Gemara here says that the conversation that ensued involved, first of all, an accusation by Yoav about the killing of Asael, as well as the fact that he then tricks him by asking him a halachic question that put him in this compromised position, which is he asked him, how does a Yuvama, who has no arms, go ahead and untie the shoe? Abner was demonstrating how to do it. That put Abner into that compromised position of bowing down, and then Yoav kills him in that position. But they're playing on the word Sheila, Sheli, Shal, which is Shal Nalecha, which has to do with the shoe, Sheila, that he asked him a question. It also could relate, again, to that it was because of him, meaning that it was Abner's fault that he was being killed, because Abner, who killed Asael, made a mistake. And that's the word Sheli. Sheli means to make a mistake or to mislead. And Abner was misled by his thinking that he could use lethal force against Asael, which was wrong. And so that also could be a play on the word here. Vayokehu sham el chomesh, and midah keneged midah, in a sense, Yoav kills Abner by stabbing him in the fifth rib, the way that he had killed his brother Asael. Am Rabbi Yochanan bedofen chamishin makom shemarav kavei tluim bo. The same member that we brought from Rabbi Yochanan before, that the fifth rib is the place where the liver and the spleen are joined together, and they are very close to the rib cage. V'shiv Hashem et damo al rosho, asher paga b'shnei anashim tzadikim v'tovim imenu. So here, after Benayel ben Yada strikes Yoav dead, based on the instructions of Shlomo Melech when he's holding onto the Mizbeach, and the Navi says, Hashem brought back the blood on the head of Yoav, and he murdered or killed two great men, tzadikim v'tovim imenu, who were more righteous and better than he. So the Pasuk says that Abner and Asael had something on Yoav, that Yoav deserved to die for killing these quote-unquote innocent individuals. Tovim sheyu dorshim achim v'rakim v'hu lo dorash. The first of which is that they were doresh achim v'rakim, which means when the king asks you to violate the Torah, you're not allowed to follow his instructions. Both Abner and Asael demur the instructions of the king, which is, by the case of Abner, when Shaul asks him to kill out Nov, Yira Kohanim, Abner and his troops refuse to do it. And only afterward, Doeg Adomi and the others go in and do it on behalf of Shaul. But they refuse to carry out the orders of Shaul because they thought they were illegal, immoral, against the Torah. And similarly, the story that we saw before by Asael, where he's going to gather the troops and they're beginning the new Masechta, he delays in gathering the troops because of the learning. So both of them follow the Torah precepts over the command of the king. Whereas Yoav did not do that. The incident in which Yoav follows the word of the king despite the lack of maybe moral, the lack of morality or justification in the Torah is in the killing of Uriah Hitti. In order to cover up for David's affair with Bathsheba, he has Uriah Hitti killed. The Gemara in other places will say that Uriah was a Morid B'Malchut, that he was deserving of the death. The Navi seems to indicate otherwise, that the chait of David was the chait of killing Uriah Hitti, which compounded the problem of Bathsheba. The way that he does it is has Yoav expose Uriah Hitti and be killed because they retreat behind him, they leave him near the wall exposed to the enemy, and he gets killed. So Yoav carries out the word of David or the instruction of David, despite the fact that it's not a justifiable killing of an individual. Tzadikim, Shem Bepet, Velo Asu. They received the instructions directly from the king. Abner received the instructions directly from Shaul, and Asael received the instructions directly from David. Despite that fact, they defied the king's order because the Torah didn't indicate it otherwise. Behu Beigeret Asa. And yet the king never spoke to Yoav directly. He sent them a letter in order to instruct him to take care, quote unquote, of Uriah Hitti. And despite the fact they didn't hear it directly, only got it in a letter, he follows the orders of the king against what would have been the Torah law in this instance. Amasa lo nishma b'cherev asher bi'ad Yoav. And Amasa was not careful or was not aware of the sword that was in the hand of Yoav. Again here, he doesn't think that Yoav is coming to kill him. He thinks that there's a peaceful meeting going over here. And therefore, he did not guard himself against the sword that was in the hand of Yoav. Amrav shlo chashdo, that he didn't suspect him. He didn't suspect that Yoav was going to kill him over here. He had just sued for peace with David after merit of Shalom. David had appointed him as the Tzar Tzava. He thought everything was happy, peaches and cream. And now Yoav comes along. He doesn't suspect that Yoav is going to kill him. And therefore, he does not guard himself against Yoav's sword that is drawn. So they bury Yoav in his house in the desert. Atu beitao midbaru. Since when is his house a midbar? What do you mean that Yoav's house is a midbar, or he's out in the midbar? Am Rav Yehuda Marav kim midbar. Just like the desert. Ma midbar mufkar lakol. Af beito shel Yoav mufkar lakol. Just like a desert is open to all, I mean it's not owned by anybody, it's area that lacks ownership or is free for anybody who goes through it because it's just not inhabited area. So too, the house of Yoav was mufkar lakol. Was open to everyone, as we're going to see in the Gemara in just a second, but Rashi notes it over here, that means that he was giving tzedakah, that aniim were welcome in his house at any time, and that he fed and mefarnes the aniim of the generation. Just like a midbar doesn't have theft, and doesn't have arayot, it's a place where there is no one and there are no possessions. The statement about Yoav's integrity, he did not steal and did not engage in arayot, despite his position as the Tzar Tzava, which would have given the right to take money or possessions from people or from the booty that was captured in war, as well as it would permit him to be engaged in Yifat Tawar and arayot, and despite all of that, he never did that. Despite all of that was in his power and his purview, he did not do that. And so it's a positive statement about Yoav. And then it says in Divrei Yamim, Yoav yichyet ashar ha'ir, that Yoav supported the remainder of the city. Here it's speaking about the conquest of Metzudat Zion, when they conquered Yerushalayim. And it says there that Yoav supported the remainder of the city. There it's probably in military terms. But here the Gemara Darshins, Amir Yehuda, Filu Monine, Vitzachanto Ta'im Parisluhu, that even little items he would put out for them. Rashi over here claims that monini are dagim ktanim, and tzachanta is min dagim ktanim, small fish, and a different type of small fish. Though as the Mesorah Shas notes over here, Rashi in other places says that tzachanta is dagim ktanim, and then monini is tsir dagim ktanim. It is brine, fish brine from small fish. So both of these are little items. These are insignificant items. And what it says is that Yoav himself would not enjoy a small pleasure in life or eat even these small items without allowing the Aniyim to join him, without giving to the Aniyim of that which he had. It's a very positive statement about the generosity and the tzedakah that Yoav performed. And that is the way that we end off the parak on a good note about Yoav. And it's true in the Navi's description of Yoav as well. And now you're finding the Gemara doing the same thing, which is Yoav is a very mixed personality. Yoav does a lot of great things. Yoav is very successful and helps David and supports David through many trials and tribulations. And Yoav does a lot of positive. On the other hand, Yoav also does things that are negative. Killed Avner, he gives David a hard time in different situations. And so here the Gemara is giving you also that type of balance in Yoav's personality where they think that Yoav did the wrong thing in certain circumstances, but that still doesn't take away from the fact that he was also a huge Baal Tzedakah, according to the Gemara. But again, that idea that Yoav is a very, very complex personality in the Navi, and the Gemara is reflecting that in both the difference of opinions about Yoav, as well as even within the opinions of Yoav, that there are certain aspects of him that are really great, and other aspects of him that are really problematic. Right? With that, we finish the sixth parak, Adon Alach, Nigmar Adin. And so as in the previous prakim, the Mishnah in this parak continues what we just saw before, which is, Arba mitot nimsru lebeitin. Four death penalties are given in the purview of Beitin to execute. Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Vechenek. We've spoken about them already. what we dealt with, and that's what the Mishnah is going to say in a second, is skila. And now the Mishnayot are going to deal with the other three types of executions or death penalties that Beit Din has the right to pose. B'Shimon Omer, Sreifa, Skila, Henek, V'Cherek, this I mentioned a number of times in the previous parak, that Rabbi Shimon agrees with the categorization of Skila and Sreifa as being the most severe, and Cherek and Henek being the less severe, but the order of them he disagrees with, which he thinks that Sreifa is more Chamura than Skila, and he thinks that Henek is more Chamur than Cherek. Zo mitzvat niskali. This is what we just read in the previous parak. That's the way that an execution by stoning is carried out. The Mishnayot laid out for us the whole protocol, and now the Mishnayot are going to move on to the other three mitot Beit Din to describe the procedures by which they are executed. Now, the Mishnah in saying that there are four mitot Beit Din seems to be a limiting factor. We're going to see in the Gemara in a second that the order is important, and maybe that's what the Mishnah is coming to teach you, which is the hierarchy or the chumrah by which each of these are viewed. It has a nafkamina when someone is chayav, two death penalties. We give him the more severe of the two. Or in a case where you have a safek, people got mixed up, we're both deserving the death penalty, and one is deserving of a lower death penalty than the other, we'll kill both of them with a lower death penalty, because you have a safek over there. So there's a nafkamina in terms of the order or the hierarchy of the death penalties. But others also suggest over here that there might be a statement that these are the rights or the purview of Beit Din, but a king who also has a right to kill someone who's married by Malchut and to adjudicate and deal with the people, he doesn't have the right to use these four mitot Beit Din. He only has the right to use Hereg, the sword. That's the only vehicle that's given to the king, whereas the Beit Din is given these four vehicles to mete out the punishments or the death penalties that are dictated by the Torah. Anytime the Mishnayot give you a listing by number, there is no order in the way that is listed, with the exception of the seven ingredients that are mentioned in the Mishnah in Nidah. So here he's making a statement that many times we find in the Mishnah, arba of this, chamisha of this, sheva of this. All of those are not necessarily ordered in a hierarchical manner. They are simply a list of items. You can't conclude anything from the order in which they are written in the Mishnah. It says the one exception is the seven ingredients that are brought in the Mishnah Nidah. So it's not Shiva Smanim Ma'virin Aleketem. Use these seven agents or cleansing agents when you want to clean off a stain from a baguette, from a piece of clothing. And Rashi says over here, you shouldn't read the word sam to mean a rifu'ah or some sort of medicinal salve. Rather, the word sam is always something that's opposing, something that removes or contrasts with something else. And that's what he writes here, v'ein sam noshon bosem, that sam is not some sort of herb or aromatic perfume, v'lo leshon marpeh, and not a medicinal cure, el leshon davar tzarich l'tikun chavero, something that's needed to fix something else, or to contrast or remove an item from something else. And so therefore, when it's used in the medical context, it means something that is a cure for the disease that the individual has. When it's used in a perfume or aromatic sense, it means something that smells nice, that removes a bad smell or projects a good smell. And when it's used here, in this case, the sam is the agents of cleansing that take away the stain or the dirt. And therefore, sam has a more generic meaning that we might have thought about given its usage in Shas. And here are the ingredients. Rok tafel, saliva that has not tasted anything that day. It's raw saliva, which doesn't have other liquids or other food that has been placed in it. So it's when a person wakes up in the morning, that first saliva that's produced, that's one of the ingredients. That saliva has higher fermentation qualities, and therefore it's a better cleanser. The word tafel means something that's bland or without flavor. And so that's what the rok tafel is, a bland or saliva without anything mixed into it. Megrisim, the liquids that come from the crushing of beans. Meraglayim, urine. Vineter, natron, or it's some sort of carbonate of soda. Borit, which is lye. And kemulia, v'ashleich, or ashleig. And as Rashi describes over here, kemulia is a type of earth that is rich in minerals, cleansing agents. And the ashleich, or the ashleig, is some sort of herb or spice that also has cleaning properties to it, that was part of these mananim. Tani Seifa, and the Seifa of that mission says, Heviran Shalokis Sidran, if you cleansed or washed, laundered the beged with these items, not in the order that they're listed in the Mishnah, or Shiviran Shivatan Kechad, or use them all together at once, Lo Asav Lo Klom, it doesn't work. Meaning that the list here is hierarchical in nature, and you have to do them exactly in this order. The potency of each of them is increased by the one that is used before, and therefore the order is important. So he's saying that this is the one Mishnah where you have an enumeration by number, where we say that that number is telling you an exact order, it's telling you a level of hierarchy, and that is true there, but not anywhere else. Now, the reason for that Mishnah, there's machloket here between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi claims that the cleaning agent is to determine whether it's dam or not dam, which is that blood, when you use these cleaning agents, blood will come out of the beged. The beged will then be clean, and the dam or the stain of the dam will be removed. On the other hand, if it's a dyed beged, it's a stain there that's not removable, then these agents will not be successful at removing it. So if you want to determine that the stain or the red markings that you have on the beged, you want to know whether they're dam or whether they're a ketem, a stain or a dyeing of sorts, then you'd use the test of using these cleansing agents to determine whether it's removed or not removed. That's what Rashi says it's used for. On the other hand, the Balei Tosfot bring the Rabbeinu Tam, who suggests that it's a case where for sure we know it's dam on the beged. We know there's blood there, but we want to negate the effects of the dam. You do that by cleansing it in this manner, so that even if the stain remains afterwards, the dam is no longer considered to be dam anymore, something that is tamei, because you've now, in a sense, diluted or washed away the dam to the point that it's no longer classified as dam. Papa Sava Mishmei Derav Amar. So the elder of Papa, this is to differentiate the Stam Rav Papa and Shas, who is the Talmid of Rava. Over here you have the older Rav Papa, who here is quoting Rav, so he's a earlier Amora, meaning that he's the second generation Amora, Amar Af Arba Mitot. Our Mishnah is another example of which you have an enumeration by number that is also hierarchical in nature, which is the list of the Mitot in the Mishnah, not only a list of the Mitot, but a list of the Mitot in the order of their severity, which is Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Vechenek. That's the order according to the Chachamim. So, Medikah, Maflig, Rabbi Shimon, Shmamina, Daf, Kaktani. And the evidence is the fact that Rabbi Shimon disagrees. Shimon gives you the same listing, but he changes the order. That shows you that the order in the Reisha was significant or meaningful. Beidach. So then, why doesn't Rav Sechora over here also do the same thing and bring our Mishnah as an example? Beplokto lo kamayri. He's not dealing with machloket. He's not dealing with mishnayot that involve machloket. Because in mishnayot that involve machloket, our mishnah, first of all, it's obvious that they are in order because of the fact that the other individual lists them in a different order. So he says, I don't need to explain that. That's not what my statement was about. But Papa Amar, af seder yoma, that the order of the avoda on Yom Kippur that is brought in mishnayot in yoma, that's also something where you have a list of items that is an order, and the order is me'akev. Titnan, komasei yom ha-kippurim amurim ala seder. All the avodah yom kippur that's listed out in the Mishnayot is written in order. Imdim masei l'chaviro la'asav alo klom. If he does anything out of order, it's me'akev. It does not count towards completing the avodah of yom ha-kippurim. V'idach. So then again here, why didn't Rav Schora include this? Veida chao chumra ba'alma. Over there, it's just a chumra ba'alma. When you deal with order, there are different reasons why something can be in order. Something can be in order because it's sequential in nature, which is that you want one thing to happen before the next thing, to happen before the next thing. But that is no statement about the ranking of those items. It doesn't mean that the first item is more important than the second item, or the second item is more important than the third item. It just means that the order is me'akev. On the other hand, you can have a listing in order, because the order matters, not in terms of the sequential nature, but in terms of the hierarchy, or the chumrah, or severity of the item. And so what they're pointing out here is that, in Yom HaKippurim, there is an order that is me'akev, but it's chumrah v'almahu, meaning it's not associated with the stringency, severity, or the ranking of the item. It's simply a requirement of the Avodah Yom Kippurim based on the Pasuk that says Chukah, that uses the word Chok with regards to Yom Kippurim. It tells us that the order is Me'akev. And that's what Rashi says over here. Av Yom Kippurim Chomer Yom Ba'almu. It has to do with the severity, stringency of the day. Shol Lishnot Bo. V'lo Koach Avodot. That it has to do with the fact that you may not change anything. It has nothing to do with the strength or ranking of the Avodot. And so he says, I'm telling you that the Smanim, the ingredients that are used in the Mishnah Nida, are talking about the ingredient that is the most efficacious in terms of cleansing, and then you move from one to the next, so that they build upon each other, and therefore the order there is not just important in terms of its sequential nature, but the order there is important in terms of the efficacy and the strength of the item. And so that's why I say that that list is in order, and I don't quote that in Yoma, because Yoma is an order not having to do with hierarchy, but having to do with the nature of the day. Rav Huna, Breder of Yeshua, Mar Af Seder Tamid, that not only is Seder Yom HaKippurim, but the Seder Tamid, Diktani, Allah, Zeu Seder Tamid, because over there, by the Mishnah Yod, it says this is the order of the way that Tamid's done. Now this question's not in Rav Schora, because Rav Schora already told us that when it has to do with the ordering of items, that's not what he's speaking about. He's speaking about hierarchy of items. But the question now is on Rav Papa, who included Seder Yoma, why doesn't he also include Seder HaTamid, which also the Mishnah says has to be done in order? V'idach, Rav Papa would answer you all the mitzvah ba'alma, that is l'chatchila, but not b'diavad. We prefer the proper way to do it is in this order, but if you do it out of order, it's not me'akev. Ula Fuke. Now Rav Schora's statement that comes along here and says that when you enumerate items in a Mishnah, they are not in order, they're not hierarchical in nature, with the exception of the Mishnah Nida. Which Mishnayot was he indicating otherwise? Which Mishnayot are not like that? So one of them is the Mitzvah Chalitza. The Mitzvah Chalitza is brought in Masechet Yevamot. It's not. Mitzvah Chalitza. How does Chalitza work? Bahu v'yevamto lifnei beitin. The individual, the Yavam, and the Yavama come to Beitin. You know, Nimlo, Eitzaha Ugenet Lo. They give him proper advice what to do in this situation. Shenemar, Vikarulo, Zikneiro, Vidiru Elav. So the Zikinim of the city call him. This is again, this passage is Parsha Kitetze, that the elders of the city call him in, and they speak to him. Now, there in the Torah, it tells you what they say to him. But here, the Gemara views Vidiru Elav as a separate conversation that they have with him. And there they're discussing whether it's appropriate for him to marry this woman or not. If there's a huge age gap between them, do we dissuade them from getting married or performing Yibum in that situation? So trying to give him advice as to whether this is a good idea or not a good idea. V'hiyo meret, and then the woman says, Me'ein Yivami, that my Yavam is unwilling to marry me and carry out the mitzvah of Yibum. V'hiyo mer, lo chafatzi lakachta, and he says, I have no interest in taking her and in marrying her. And they say it in Hebrew. I mean, that's a requirement that the performance of the ceremony of the chalitza must be done, or the psukim must be read in Hebrew. That's based on the Gemara in Sotah, which tells us that that's the case. So then they go on with the procedure of the yibum, which is they come before the yivama, and in front of this zkenim, she takes off the shoe from the avam, and then v'yarka b'fanav, she spits in front of him. The pashtut of pasuk is v'yarka b'fanav, she spits into his face. I mean, it's a certain amount of denigration that is done to the individual. Now, Chazal interpreted that or reinterpreted that to mean roka nira l'dayanim. B'fanav, not to mean literally just spit into his face, rather just spit on the ground, but this spit or the saliva has to be something that the dayanim can see. It has to be visible. Spit. Vantava amra. And then she goes ahead and reads the following, or says the following. Kach yaseh l'ish. Right, this is what you do to the person that didn't want to build his brother's house. V'nikra shmo b'Yisrael. And then they call his name amongst Klal Yisrael, Chalutza now. Sarami Yehuda, mitzvah chalitza. The mitzvah chalitza is the following. Korah. She first reads, which is what we saw here in the Mishnah, Ma'ein Yivami. V'korei. And then he reads, which is lo chafatzi l'kachta. Choletzet, takes off the shoe. Rokeket, she spits. Bekorah, and then she reads the final passage is there about what you do to someone who refuses to carry out Yibum. Vavinan ba, Maika Mashmalan. We asked about this. Rav Yehuda is just telling us what's found in the Mishnah. Matznitani, it is the Mishnah itself. All he's doing is repeating for us what the things that are found in the Mishnah. Hakamash Malan, mitzvah hochi. That is the primary proper way to do it. The apich leitan ba. But if he changes the order or does it out of order, we're not going to get worked up about that. But here you see that the order does not me'akev, or the order or hierarchy is not necessarily meaningful in that Mishnah. Tanya nami ochi. But a braita that supports that contention, ben shikdim chalitza l'rikika, or rikika l'chalitza, doesn't matter whether the spit was done first or the removal of the shoe was done first, mashasa soy, whatever is done is done. Even though there is a proper way to do it based on what the mission says, is first to take off the shoe and then to spit, nevertheless, if it's done out of order, it still works. Ula fuke mehadetznan, and the statement of tzchora also comes to exclude from this Mishnah. Kohen gadol mishamesh b'shmona kelim. The Kohen Gadol wears 8 garments to serve in the Mikdash. Kohen Gadol to Barba. And the regular Kohen, he serves with 4 Bigadim. And now it lists the Bigadim. Ktonet, the tunic. Michnasayim, the knickers, the shorts. Mitznefet, the hat. Vavnetan, the belt. Mosif Aleim Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol adds on top of those 4 Bigadim of the Kohen Gadol, Choshen, the breastplate, the ephod, and the apron. Umi'il, and the cloak, vitzitz, and the headband. So these are the 8 begadim of the Kohen Gadol. As the Gemara points out of here, Tanya, minayin shlo yedavar kodem nechzasayim. How do you know that the first piece of clothing that the Kohen has to put on are the nechzasayim, which are his boxers, knickers, or pants that he wore? Shnemar, umichnesay badiyu al basaro. The nechzasayim should be directly on his body, with nothing else intervening. So then, why did you write ktonet first in the Mishnah if the michnasayim have to be the first thing that's put on? Should the aktamei kro? Because the pasuk speaks about the ktonet before the michnasayim. The pasuk says, ktonet bad kodesh yubash, umichnasay bad yubash al bisaro. So it mentions ktonet first, and then michnasayim. So now the Gemara asks for kro my time aktamei. So then why did the pasuk put them out of order? Yishom de michsaya kula gufe adifale. The ketonet is the most significant of all the garments that are there. It's the tunic that covers his whole body. So the Torah speaks about it first, even though it's not necessarily the first thing that he needs to put on. The michsaya is the first thing he has to put on. So we mentioned in the Mishnah, ketonet before michsaya, mimicking the way the Torah does it, which is puts ketonet before michsaya. But that's not indicative of necessarily the order in which they need to be put on, or the significance of the items. And over here you see that the michnasayim have to be put on first, despite the fact that the Mishnah mentions ketonet first. So that's what this statement of Rav Schora comes to say, to exclude that Mishnah by the Kohanim, that even though you have an enumeration of items, 4 begadim, 8 begadim, they're not written in an exact order. And the Baalei HaTosafot over here point out that there were other examples that they could have brought as well, which is Seder Brachot in Rosh Hashanah. Also, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah about Seder Tkiot, the order of the Tkiot, which also me'akev. We do have other examples in Shas where it is me'akev, and you'd have to work out in each of those instances as to whether it's not true what we're thinking, and they are not necessarily in order, or dictating an order or hierarchy, or are they subsumed under another category that we already mentioned. Okay, we're going to stop here by the 2 dots on the bottom of Memtet Amud Bet.
That's just...